We begin a class series on these Bodhisattva precepts, the three collective precepts in our Zen tradition as presented by Asanga, the ancient Indian Mahayana teacher. Bodhisattva practice, Bodhisattva precepts are amazing topic to me. They're so vast and so inspiring and really encompass our whole practice. And so much about how we live day to day, right? So sometimes we talk about the nuances of meditation, and which also I think can apply to our day-to-day life, but Bodhisattva precepts is like how we actually like put it into action in the world day-to-day. And this treatise has lots of, you know, different practices that we can do. It's from ancient times in India, and yet it seems totally relevant to modern day America. This is how Bodhisattva precepts are. So in our Zen tradition, Soto Zen, in the Soto Shu constitution, this document that kind of helps define this particular lineage of Buddhism in Japan, as I recall, it's something like the two tenets of the Soto school, according to the constitution, which is basically based on Dogen, are the non-duality of practice and realization, which I think everybody's heard about this practice, and the verification of awakening are not two. So one moment of practicing Zazen is, you know, completely practicing Zazen is verifying the fruit of awakening at that moment. In other words, practice isn't like a means to an end in the future. Practice and realization, not two. Very important teaching of Dogen. And another tenet, the other tenet of the Soto school is Zen and the precepts are one suchness. I don't know if Dogen said that exactly, directly like that, but it's implied. You can find places where Dogen talks in this way. Just sitting Zazen, in the mind of Zazen, all the precepts are fulfilled. He says things like that. So Zen means both meditation and also just the broader meaning of the mind of non-grasping, we might say. Zen is a big topic.
So these were new to Japan through Dogen and not part of Chan in China?
I think this way of talking, I think you could find it in Chan in China, but to specifically say it like this, I think it's kind of unique to Dogen, and definitely an emphasis of Dogen.
Yeah.
To say that practice and realization are not two. You can find earlier teachings, but Dogen really brought that out. And Zen and precepts, not too. Maybe was there in China, but I don't recall any earlier teachings on this. Maybe Chinese Chan didn't emphasize the precepts as part of the essence of Zen so much, but Dogen really was into the Bodhisattva precepts in this way. So in that way, Bodhisattva precepts are like the central practice of Zen, could be seen as central practice, not separate from Zen itself. Mm-hmm. And I think you all know Being Upright, this book by Tenzin Reb Anderson, Zen Meditation and the Bodhisattva Precepts, in which he beautifully talks about that point, amongst many other points. We just had a parinirvana ceremony for the Buddha, and in his last teaching, one version of his last teaching, as he's lying there on his last night, he says, After my parinirvana, when I disappear from this world, all of you should revere and honor the precepts, the standards of conduct. This is like finding a light in the darkness, or like a poor person obtaining a treasure. You should know that they are your great teacher and are not different from my actual presence in the world. It's like the Buddha saying that, don't worry about it after I'm gone. Your teacher will still remain as these precepts. And maybe elsewhere he would have said, you know, the mind of Zazen will be your teacher. But in this sutra, on his last evening, he's like, this is like the essential thing. These precepts will be my presence in the world. How we live in the world will be enacting the Buddha. So it's this term Shila in Sanskrit, or Sila in Pali, is what we translate as precepts. Kai is the Chinese-Japanese character that's used to translate Shila. So Jukai is receiving the precepts. But this term Shila is quite dynamic. So I think we usually translate it as precepts, but it could also be like translated as like ethics or morality or virtue, like this. So maybe it has this one quality that's like this actual delineation of particular practices, and that's why I think we use this English word precepts to receive these particular 16 bodhisattva precepts. But we could translate it as receiving ethics or receiving morality. It might seem funny, well, how you receive that? So maybe that's why we use precepts. But I think it's hard to translate. I've been thinking about this recently. It's hard to capture that word Shila in one word in English that means both a particular list of practices and also the actual, you know, nature of virtue. So I looked up in English, you know, some of these words. I thought this was interesting, just the standard English dictionary. Maybe together we can see what we think is the best word to translate this, Shila or Kai. So, first of all, precepts, the word precept, which is pretty, it's not just our lineage. I think in America it's become the kind of universal word for the ceremony in particular and the practices of virtue for people practicing Buddha Dharma. Mm-hmm. Precepts is in both Tibetan Buddhism and Vipassana, Theravada and Zen. I think everybody uses this English word precepts. That's how things go, right? Somebody tries it out and it sticks and then we have to live with it. It's pretty good though. The word precepts has the etymology, actually means to take beforehand. Pre means beforehand, and sept is something like to take. So that's a nice meaning of that word for us. It's like you take up these practices before you go out into the world and decide whether you're going to be helpful or harmful. You take them beforehand and then you have that vow. So precept is I think works in that way. But literally is in the dictionary it says a command or principle intended as a general rule of action or a law. So it actually doesn't have anything about ethics or morality in the English definition of precepts. It just means to take something beforehand, and it's a general rule. So I think general rule means kind of like we all have the same precepts. We agree on these, you know, instead of just deciding I'm going to be good like this. But it misses this whole realm of Shila, right? Ethics, I think, is a pretty good one. I think ethics, it has a little bit like, to me, that word in English has some feeling of almost like a philosophy course in college on ethics. It's maybe a little dry sounding or something, just in my mind. But the definition, I think, really works, because ethics is a set of moral principles or values, the discipline dealing with what is good and bad, and with moral duty and obligation. Mm-hmm. So particularly this good and bad issue, which we'll have to get into here, if we're talking about precepts. But ethics is these principles or discipline, which is like a practice dealing with, you know, what's virtuous and unvirtuous. I think that's a good definition of Sila, is ethics, and some people do translate it that way. Morality is very similar. Rules of conduct dealing with principles of right and wrong in behavior. And the etymology for morality is something like custom. It means, in original Latin, I suppose, or some language, something like custom. So it has these particular, like, there's something, some standard being passed along. Also, it says a synonym is virtue. And virtue it actually comes from virile or strong. It's related. Which I think is interesting because we have this paramita called enthusiasm or vigor, called virya paramita. And virya is, in Sanskrit, is related to the English word virile. But this is a different paramita, Sila paramita. But has that sense of maybe we're holding something strongly. And virtue is defined as conformity to a standard of right or morality or moral excellence. So these ethics, morality, and virtue are closely related. And then one other word that we could, that these are all words that are being used in different English groups to translate Sila. Discipline is another one, which I think doesn't quite capture this particular issue about wholesome or unwholesome, but the word discipline means, or comes from the root of like teaching, learning, or training. So that is an aspect of precepts for us. Training that corrects, molds, or perfects the mental faculties or moral character. Orderly or prescribed conduct or pattern of behavior. System of rules governing conduct. That's similar to this term. And then some people say, combine these to say like ethical discipline or moral discipline or the precepts of morality or virtuous conduct and so on. So it's just, these are all dimensions of this term that means particular, you know, guidelines. In of course, in Buddha Dharma, precepts are never seen as like commandments that you must do this. They're always seen as recommendations or guidelines that are can be willingly taken up, received. They're far from being forced on one, one has to actually ask to receive them, and we call it receiving the precepts as a way to commit to a kind of practice. So what is it about commitment? Asanga will talk about this some, but something about that the mind easily changes. So we can decide, feel really inspired, I want to live for the benefit of all beings, and I want to avoid doing these things that are kind of habitual things for me, in which I harm people, and I'm going to do that. There. I'm going to do it. And then, of course, our habits kick in, and the next day we go against all that, so we forget it, or our mind changes it. Maybe that was just a moment of inspiration yesterday, now today I don't care about that so much. So I think that very practical reason is actually the main reason for commitments to different practices or precepts. like we when we feel in our heart, I want to go in this direction, and I say, and I'm going to vow or commit to this because I know my mind is fickle and easily changeable. So why this treatise from Asanga? Well, in our Zen tradition, we have these 16 bodhisattva precepts that I think most people know of, the three refuges in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the three pure precepts, which is the topic for this class, and then the 10 grave bodhisattva precepts. And we often hear and talk about the 10. It's a very nice list of very practical practices. And maybe the three pure precepts seem kind of vague to us. They seem so broad and open that we maybe don't talk about them as much. So that's one reason I thought, let's bring out this treatise that's particularly on these three pure precepts in great delineation. And where does this come from in our Zen tradition, these 16? Well, the three refuges go back to the Buddha's time, or the very beginning. The 10 grave precepts are an interesting evolution. Basically, the version that we have is straight out of what we call the Brahmajala Sutra, which is a Mahayana sutra, became very popular in China. But that sutra that was, scholars now say, was probably written in China. You know, a lot of Mahayana sutras maybe were revealed later than the Buddha's time in India, but most of them were actually emerged in India, but this one maybe came quite a bit later in China. We don't know for sure, but the style of its writing seems to be that way. But it became like the standard. This is the Buddha's teaching on bodhisattva precepts, and those 10 are related to these 10 virtuous actions from the early sutras as well. But the particular delineation that we use now is based on this Brahmajala Sutra. And still in China and Japan, Japanese Soto Zen, they sometimes will recite the whole Brahmajala Sutra in precept ceremonies. So it's definitely connected. It's not just randomly that it's the same. It's really coming from this sutra that we can study sometime. But the three pure precepts, where do they come from? They are in this one other somewhat obscure sutra that's not yet translated into English. There's one translator working on it now, and I keep emailing him and saying, are you done with that? He's translated this Rulu. I think he's a Chinese monk. This book of Bodhisattva Precepts is a bunch of Mahayana sutras, maybe like five or ten Mahayana sutras on Bodhisattva precepts. There's quite a lot of them, but they're pretty obscure. The Brahmajala Sutra is the main one that's not as obscure that we have quite a few English translations of. But he's the one working on this other one, and I think he's not done yet. But that one, that sutra, I think also is supposedly written in China. It's closely related to the Brahmajala Sutra. So we can tell some of these things, like the Tibetans is the other mainstream of Mahayana, and like they don't have the Brahmajala Sutra thing or heard of it. So that's one reason why we can guess that it probably came from China. Because both China and Tibet collect all the Indian Mahayana together. And this one too, it's called the Bodhisattva Jewel Necklace Original Conduct Sutra, is maybe Chinese origins, but it lists them. We have it in Chinese, and the way that the characters that list the three pure precepts are exactly the same as we use in modern Soto Zen. And it's sometimes referred to in Zen texts. But I think that my understanding is that this text by Asanga was actually earlier than this Chinese Jewel Necklace Sutra, and was probably based on Asanga's treatise, which may be the first in the world to really like delineate these three bodhisattva precepts in this particular way and explain what they are.
A sangha,
maybe. A sangha. Yeah, I think so, yeah. He also includes in this treatise like a little ceremony for receiving the three pure precepts, which is, I think our ceremony includes all the elements of a sanghas, maybe it's somewhat based on. And some people say this is maybe the first bodhisattva precepts ceremony in the world, a sangha. A sangha lived in, I think I wrote, 310 to 390, so a while ago. In India, the Mahayana started emerging around zero, the year zero, somewhere in there, with Prajnaparamita sutras and bodhisattva conduct and the six paramitas. All that was like the early Mahayana teachings.
Was this Nalanda? Out of Nalanda?
Well, a sangha did practice at Nalanda. Yeah, where we visited. Nalanda was, I forget what year it started. Nalanda University was this. I think there was some different schools of Buddhism, like other, like related to Theravada, as well as Mahayana, all different schools, all practicing together and sharing their ideas for maybe about 1,000 years until it was destroyed by some invasion, as happens in an impermanent world. And so yeah, during that time of Nalanda, the Mahayana started really growing. Nagarjuna lived about 150, and then Asanga and Vasubandhu, which were blood brothers and good Dharma friends, lived around this time in the 4th century. And Asanga and Vasubandhu together are considered like the kind of co-founders of the Yogacara school, sometimes called mind-only. But Yogacara really just means like yogic practice, emphasizing the kind of like, I think in general, just yoga, the word Yogacara is like emphasizing actual practice in the world. So there's a lot of writings that these two wrote about how to live as a bodhisattva. And they got into this kind of intricate philosophy and psychology of mind only. But that's just part of Yogacara. Maybe the main and most well-known part. But it includes things like this, where he doesn't even bring up mind only. And so Vasubandhu is one of our Zen ancestors that we chant, so we have less connection to him. And Asanga, sometimes they say in India, like Nagarjuna and Asanga are like the most important two Indian late teachers after the Buddha, who started these two streams of thought and just wrote a lot and had a lot of people following their ideas and evolving them afterwards. So Asanga is a really important teacher, and I really enjoy his celebration of bodhisattva practices. So this text is, this particular one, it's this tiny section of this huge, huge treatise. He's got many huge treatises, but one of them is called the Yogacara Bhumi. I don't know if it's most important. He's got so many important treatises. Yogacara Bhumi means like stages, ground, or say stages of yogic practice, we could say, is the Yogacara Bhumi. And it's like thousands of pages, 10 volumes. It's huge, huge. It's too much to translate, but sections of it have been. And within, it's like basically his kind of overview of the whole path of practice, everything he could think of he puts in here. And then there's these sections, like the Shravaka Bhumi is like, you know, so-called lesser vehicle approaches to practice, and the Prajeka Buddha Bhumi are sections. And then there's a section called the Bodhisattva Bhumi within the Yogacara Bhumi. And that's also a huge treatise in itself, bodhisattva practice of precepts and meditation and wisdom and so on. And within this bodhisattva bhumi is this chapter on sila, or bodhisattva precepts. Sorry. Yogacara Bhumi treatise, bodhisattva bhumi section, sila chapter, by Maitreya Bodhisattva, slash Arya or noble Asanga. Because in India, I think Asanga has this relationship with Maitreya Bodhisattva. I think I mentioned in Sashin, maybe some of you know this story about Asanga was in retreat and kind of supplicating Maitreya Buddha. I really want to meet Maitreya, this kind of celestial, invisible, Sambhogakaya kind of Buddha, or, you know, Buddha to be. And he would go into retreat just with this vow to meet Maitreya and practice for, I think, 3 years. And then he'd basically give up, and he'd come out and he'd see, like, a little, like, you know, mouse, you know, chip digging away like a hole through a wall that's like 5 feet thick of rock or something, but this mouse is, and I was like, well, if this mouse is like making that much effort over such a long time to get through this wall, maybe I should go back into retreat and try again. Maybe I gave up too early. So he goes another 3 years and comes out and sees something else, like some animal or person, you know, making a long, slow effort to get somewhere. And it's like, well, maybe I make some more effort. This happens several times. So after maybe 4 times of these 3 year retreats, he's like, okay, forget it now. It didn't work. I don't have the karmic disposition to meet Maitreya Buddha. But meanwhile, he was actually practicing and building up his merit and virtue and compassion and wisdom without even knowing it. And then, so as he comes out and he meets this dog, right? There's one of those Indian stray dogs that are everywhere to this day that look pretty scraggly. And this dog's like got a big wound with these maggots in it. And Asanga is just filled with overwhelming compassion and the wish to help. And so I want to remove these maggots from the wound, but I don't want to harm the maggots either. My fingers are too rough, so I'll have to use my tongue. So without any hesitation, with this mind of great compassion, he sticks out his tongue to gently lift the maggots out of this wound. And at that time, the dog turns into Maitreya Buddha. Or the dog always was Maitreya, but he then reveals himself to be Maitreya. And Asanga is, I think, kind of like upset. He's like, I just spent 12 years trying to meet you. Why did you like wait so long? And he's like, I was there with you the whole time. But your compassion wasn't fully ripened enough to meet me until right now. So I think that's a beautiful story. And then then he's like, you know, to honor Maitreya, he puts him on his shoulders and starts walking around town to like carry Maitreya through town. And everyone's saying, Asanga, why do you have that like scraggly dog on your shoulders? Because nobody else was quite ready to see Maitreya. So he had this relationship. He finally met Maitreya. And then there's the legends of like he would go up to Tushita heaven, where we hear that Maitreya lives, and receive these teachings from him. You know, in these meditation realms, going to this deva realm is not like a physical thing that you have to like make a long journey to the sky or something. It's more like it's in your mind already. Tushita heaven is already like, we have it, access to it. And I guess you could say like Asanga found that access key to Tushita heaven, so he could go there and have these long conversations with Maitreya on, you know, in normal earth time. They were like, you know, just a few minutes, but it'd be like years in Tushita heaven. These, you know, old Indians had a nice sense of like science fiction kind of feeling, right? His stories. And he kind of downloaded these treatises of Maitreya, or he kind of channeled them. So a lot of the works of Asanga he attributes to Maitreya, and some of them he says, I wrote them. So some are written by Asanga, and like the Tibetan version of this is attributed to Asanga, but the Chinese version is attributed to Maitreya. And it's interesting, we have it both, we have it in Sanskrit, Tibetan, Nepali, Chinese, Tibetan, and like four versions of Chinese. So it really was an important text for a lot of people in all these countries, and and it's been preserved. Xuanzang, the great Chinese pilgrim who translated the Heart Sutra that we chant, translated this text, and we have his, that's the main Chinese one that is used now. With these particular, I put these Chinese characters, these are Xuanzang's way of translating the Sanskrit, which I thought was interesting because this is this little like matrix, this is what's used for our Bodhisattva precepts, the Chinese version. So it's basically, this is also, this is a lot, I don't know if we'll read through all of this, but this is, it's about six pages, it's about one third of the actual chapter that I just felt like, I'm happy to email it, I have emailable to all of you, and we also have some long commentaries in English on this that I can email, but I thought, let's not print out that many pages. So I just really, for my own study and joy, I just try to spend the time to like condense this, what I felt like is, if we're going to take a third of it, what's the most important pieces? Some of it's somewhat repetitive. All of it was inspiring to me, but I felt like here's some really interesting, I think interesting pieces that really capture the summarize, the 18 pages into six. So that's what this is. And I sort of went through it and re-translated pieces. So at the top here, it's all about the three pure precepts. He doesn't mention the ten. And it's extensively elaborates on these three pure precepts. So at the top here, this is how he, we have the English version of the Sanskrit, and we have the Chinese, so here's the terms. It says Bodhisattva precepts, which is what we use in Zen too. As I say, modern Soto Zen version in parentheses. So maybe none of you read Chinese, but Tenzin Roshi, my teacher, would, whenever teaching a class, he'd always write Chinese characters on the board. I don't know how many people cared about that, but that's kind of how I learned. I started writing down what he wrote and started looking stuff up, and pretty soon I was like, sort of taught myself basic Chinese characters just from his bothering to do that. So I don't know if I would recommend it because it's kind of a big thing to learn different languages, but I'll maybe talk about it a little because it shows this evolution here. So these three pure precepts, Samvarashila or Pratimoksha Samvarashila, sometimes the Sangha uses. Usually he just says Samvarashila. Samvara is usually translated as discipline or restraint. I think those are the main, maybe vow. Discipline and restraint are the usual translations of Samvara. It's used in different ways. Even around like meditation, there's like Dhyana Samvara, like discipline or restraint for practicing meditation. But here it's Samvara Shila. So you could say the discipline, the precepts of discipline, or the ethics of discipline, or the ethics of the vow. Pratimoksha is in the earlier teachings for monastics, but also lay people. Pratimoksha precepts are the like long lists of, particularly monastic precepts, but even like the five lay precepts would be considered pratimoksha precepts. Moksha means liberation or emancipation. And prati could be like individual or, you know, case by case sometimes. But maybe we could say individual liberation precepts. And in Chinese here, so this was how Xuanzang decided to translate this, precepts of discipline. So in all of these, the last character in all these lines is kai, that we use, or jukai, that means precepts or virtue or ethics. And this is ritsu gi kai. Ritsu is the Japanese way of saying vinaya. Vinaya is like the monastic precepts in India. There's even like a Vinaya school, so the Ritsu is a Chinese way. It means like regulations. And then Gi means like manners or conduct. So it's a little bit of liberal translation that Xuanzang is doing here. So you could say like the discipline or Vinaya is usually translated as discipline too, so you could say the discipline and conduct, the precept of discipline and conduct, or since Ritsu means like regulations or laws, I've been translating here recently, playing with the translation that I just made up, of standards of conduct for those two characters. Because standards is, I think, referring to like this, these particular... It's not just general, like, good practices for bodhisattvas. It's like, you receive these particular precepts. So they're like standards, and gi is like conduct. Or, you know, sort of the embracing and sustaining standards of conduct. Tenzin Roshi's been translating it, I think in his book, he says, regulations and ceremonies.
Forms and ceremonies.
So he said Ritsu is like either regulations or forms, and he's looking at in early Vinaya, it's all these like particular forms for monks. Like in the Vinaya, you have things like, you know, you hold your bowl like this, you arrange your robe like this, you things that aren't really like ethical practices. They're forms. And gi, you could see do ceremonies. You could see, like he likes to say, this fukan zazen gi, it's the same gi. So he likes to say the ceremony for practicing zazen. And you know, it also means the manners or conduct. And I think that's really what Dogen meant with fukan zazen gi. But Tenzin Roshi, I think, likes to play with this. You know, it's just a ceremony of zazen. But I don't think probably nobody else would translate it. Fukan zazen gi as the ceremony of zazen. But you could. And here too, I think he likes to bring that out of like forms and ceremonies of like, you know, particularly living in a temple, something like that. And then that first character there is sho or setsu, and it's the same character for seshin. Seshin, the se is means to seshin is to gather the mind or collect the mind, and this character means to, in this case, to gather or collect the standards of conduct, or embrace and sustain. These are all meanings of setsu, sho. So you can see. This is what we say now, embrace and sustain for all three. And, but you could say gather or collect. Gather and collect sentient beings. Embrace and sustain is kind of nice, I think, because it works for all three. But you can see how the modern version took this, Xuanzang's precept and just put the embrace and sustain at the beginning, but used the same characters. So the next precept is, Kushala Dharma Samgrahaka Shila. Kushala means wholesome or good. And I think it's in B being upright. He tells the story about kusha grass, which was... Did you go to Sujata's village?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, we stopped
at the...
Yeah. Yeah, there's a little shrine for where the... next to Bodhgaya, where the a farmer gave some kusha grass to the Buddha to make a zafu, to make a seat on his way to the Bodhi tree. And there's a little shrine where supposedly that happened. The kusha, and there's all this kusha grass around, right around that shrine, all along the river, still growing there. I think it's just a native grass, like pampas grass, similar, and that like if you pick it, it's if it's very thin, smooth, like blade of tall reed like grass, but very sharp edges, and also very like that rough one way kind of thing, like some grasses have. And so if you even just slide your hand, he says the edges, but when you actually see kusha grass, even if you rub your hands on the flat part against the grain, it really hurts. Yeah. But if you pull your hands the other way, it's just totally smooth. You know, it's like little teeth in the grass. And so supposedly this is the etymology of kushava, is that this comes from this kusha grass, that if you pick it up unskillfully, you'll get cut. But if you pick it up skillfully, it's a very useful grass and very soft to sit on if you sit just right on it. So kusha means like skillful, and akushala means unskillful. I think it's a kind of nice etymology from this grass.
In one of the chants, it ends om kushalaya.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that yeah.
Yep. Same word. I think there's some question about, we have these mantras in Japanese.
Yeah.
And so it's like we don't have the originals, so we back translate,
yeah,
guessing. And so I think other Zen groups in America maybe use other versions. So somebody at Zen Center said, "Well, let's do it in Sanskrit because we like to do mantras, yeah, in Sanskrit." And it's, I think in Japanese, Om Kurasai Soaka. So it's Om Kushalaya Swaha.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nice because it's like, great wholesomeness, hooray. Yeah, so I think someone was thinking about this word. Yes, don't rub it the wrong way. So kushala, skillful or wholesome or good. Dharma, in this case, means like phenomena or qualities or factors. It's kind of a broad term. It doesn't mean like Buddhist teachings. Capital D Dharma. Samgrahaka is to like gather together. Samgraha is like to collect or gather. And Shila. So I think this is a very literal way of, in Chinese, it's, you know, gathering good Dharma's precept, whole Dharma precept, wholesome Dharma precept. Gathering, collecting, embracing, sustaining, wholesome or good. Again, here I've been playing with embracing and sustaining good qualities. We usually say embracing and sustaining all good, which I think fits too. I think similar meaning, but just to include that word dharmas as qualities, which are like in Abhidharma, there's all these like wholesome qualities of mind. Kushala dharmas is like the absence of greed, hate, and delusion, and so on. So you're gathering those mental qualities with this precept. But it also includes like the six paramitas, which aren't so much mental qualities, those are like just good practices.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, the meaning of embracing and sustaining all good, like good practices, I think works well too. And you can see that one, there's no parentheses because that's exactly how Xuanzang translated it, is how we currently, modern Soto Zen version. Sattvarta kriya shila, sattva, like bodhisattva, is being. Bodhisattva is an enlightenment being, and so sentient beings. And artha, I think maybe all in this case. Not sure about that. But together means benefiting all sentient beings precept. And this first line in Chinese literally means abundantly benefiting sentient beings precept. And then it's changed there into our modern version as embrace and sustain. So I think it's just a neat thing. It's like somebody decided, let's use that same, just to kind of like maybe rhyme or all go together, we'll use four character line for each of three pure precepts and start each one with the same gather or embrace and sustain. And sentient being is slightly different characters, but exactly the same. Those are two alternate ways of writing sentient being. So that one changed slightly, but the meaning is identical. To embrace and sustain sentient being, as opposed to the earlier, abundantly benefiting the sentient beings. So I think I like to say, you know, living beings or sentient beings, embrace and sustain all being. I mean, we could say all being is sentient, but in Sangha, he's particularly talking about interacting with other people and animals and sentient beings. So he'll get into this later, but that's the background of these three pure precepts. The Sanskrit, the Xuanzang's translation of into Chinese of this text of a Sangha, and then the Soto Zen version. Oh, and just to mention too, Dogen, I say modern Soto Zen because sometime since Dogen, something slightly shifted. That have these, to use embrace and sustain, because we have Shobogenzo Jukai, it's a Shobogenzo fascicle called Conferring the Precepts, Jukai, and he lists, of course, the 16 precepts in there, and we have that fascicle in Chinese, and that one, he uses the exact same wording as Asanga. He doesn't say embrace and sustain for all of them. He actually says, abundantly benefiting sentient beings. So, I thought that, again, confirms for me that, like, and I don't think Dogen made this up, using these three pure precepts. He was part of the Tendai school. I think they were already using the three pure precepts and the 10 Bodhisattva precepts. And Dogen continued that. But it looks like this Japanese Mahayana tradition, which Dogen in his lifetime used to transmit the precepts, was this version from Asanga. The exact same, you know, wording, characters used in Asanga's treatise. I feel like, oh, this is really, I feel like this really is the basis of these three, probably the earliest basis that we have anyway of the three pure precepts. So, any questions so far? This is a lot of sort of historical background and overview before jumping in. So, what is the essence of precepts? Or, you know, every time it says precepts here, you could say ethics. In fact, the Mark Tats that translated this from Sanskrit and looking at the Tibetan uses ethics everywhere for Shila. He's, what is the essence of ethics? And I almost left it like that, but then I thought, well, but we usually use, I try to use terms that we use more. We usually say precepts. Same, Shila. Right? What's the essence of Shila? Kai. Briefly, to possess four qualities constitutes the essence of Bodhisattva precepts. What are the four? To correctly receive it from someone else, to have a quite purified intention, to make correction after failure, and to avoid failure by generating respect and remaining mindful of that. Because he has correctly received it from someone else, when the Bodhisattva fails in his training, then dependent upon the other, embarrassment will be born. This is maybe a little like difficult word for us. So let us read the paragraph and then come back to this. Because of her quite purified intention, When the bodhisattva fails in her training, then dependent upon herself, a sense of shame will be born. It's a loaded term. Correcting the bases of training after failure and generating respect so that failure will not occur in the first place are both causes for a bodhisattva's freedom from regret. So dependent upon a correct reception and a purified intention, shame and embarrassment are produced. With a sense of shame and embarrassment, in parentheses, self-respect and conscience, the correct receiving of precepts will be preserved. Preserving it, one will be free of regret. So this is interesting that before talking about the precepts themselves, he's going to talk about, like, this is the essence of precepts, is these four ways that they actually, like, are maintained. So these words that I really didn't want to leave it translated as shame and embarrassment. And I changed it a couple times, and then I thought, like, I can't, it doesn't work. So this is what is going on here.
Those are the words that Mark has.
Yeah, he used those. But I put this thing in parentheses here, because it's these terms that are, you come up in, like, Abhidharma, in the delineation of all these qualities in Sanskrit, hri and apatrapya. And, hri is often translated as, sometimes translated as shame, but also modesty, conscience, or self-respect. My teacher's talked about these two quite a few different times, and he likes to translate it. These two often usually go together, and he often translates self-respect and decorum. Decorum isn't a word we don't use very much, but apatrapya is translated as fear of blame, fear of wrongdoing. It could also be shame, conscience, concern, modesty, embarrassment, or decorum. So basically, these are classified actually as wholesome dharmas in the Abhidharma list, and they say this is what maintains a person's, like, good conduct in the world. And they basically mean, like, shame, what we might call shame, or self-respect is like prevents us from, like, you know, if we're really angry at someone, I'm just going to hit them now, or like. And we restrain ourselves out of our own self-respect. We're like, no, I really, like, it's a, you know, that's why conscience, I think, also could work here. Like, we have this inner sense of, like, no, I'm really angry, I really want to hit them, but, like, in my heart, even though I'm, like, enraged, I actually feel respect, enough self-respect for myself that, like, I don't feel good about that. Mm-hmm. Even never having heard about bodhisattva precepts, most people have some sense of this. People who don't have any sense of it are, like, kind of deranged, right? Mm-hmm. And they're like murderers or whatever, sociopaths. And that's why it's considered, if you don't have this, you're like, it's a really unwholesome dharma. And it's a natural thing. I think self-respect is a very nice word that I don't have a problem with. To say shame, I think shame, the reason I didn't say self-respect is because they're talking about when they go against the bodhisattva precepts, then they have shame. And if you put in self-respect there, it doesn't quite work to say, well, if they fail in this precept of, you know, and they start harming others, they feel self-respect. That wouldn't work, right? Yeah. So I couldn't, again, I think the Sanskrit maybe has both of these senses, but it's the same word. So when you're talking about if you go against your natural conscience, then you feel personally ashamed, whether or not anybody says anything. And the other one, apatrapya, is related to what you think others think, basically. So that this fear of wrongdoing or fear or embarrassment in others, you're like, I really want to hit this person, I'm so upset. But, like, others are really going to, like, it'll be so embarrassing afterwards, and others are really blame me for this. And so I'm restraining myself it's more public, right? One's kind of private and one's kind of public. And they're closely, they're almost always listed as a pair, but they're slightly different. So one's maybe like fear of self-blame and fear of other blame, you could say. Or, you know, concern for one's own self-respect, concerns for respect from others. They're both in a way like conscience, I think, but maybe the first one's more like just internal conscience, and the second's a little more like, you could say it's kind of like, well, isn't that sort of contrived? Why do we care so much what others think? But it's interesting that the Buddha said, no, this is actually, it's good that you care what others think. In this case, around kind of shared morality of the world, that everybody, if you to beat somebody up, everybody in every culture agrees, they're like, no, that's not good. So like, these two work together as wholesome dharmas, and I think it's nice to contemplate how they might not feel good when they're happening, but they actually keep us on track. It's a beautiful teaching. And there's one Pali Sutta that when I was looking up different translations of these, something in the Pali Canon, I think the Sutra is called, or the Buddha calls these two dharmas the guardians of the world. The guardians of the world is this self-respect and decorum, or fear of embarrassment. Did you have a question?
No, I was just going to comment. I've heard a lot of teachings on this, and it's always brought up. We just have trouble with these words, and I think it's rooted in kind of our cultural tendency to self-denigration, and so we have this other context around shame. And, rather than, I think the connecting it to self-respect is really beautiful and immediately puts this in another context. My thoughts or my actions are actually going against my own self-respect and my own, desire.
Another word, maybe another translation we could use is integrity. My own sense of integrity.
Well, another troublesome part is this whole idea of when a bodhisattva fails.
Yes.
Training.
Yes. Yeah.
And I mean, we don't usually put it that way.
No, we don't. We could say.
Or falls short.
Falls short.
And that's not. Maybe it sounds like we're trying to, just make it a little lighter, but we don't really. I mean, being perfect is not really our goal.
Yeah,
it's really sort of watching.
Yeah,
and monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're not living up to our intention, this mindfulness bell goes off, and something, this word in Sanskrit, kind of pulls us back up.
Yeah,
and
maybe we could even maybe it'd be a little clunkier, longer thing, but we could say you said something like we forget our intention.
Yeah.
You could say when a bodhisattva forgets their intention and starts to harm others or whatever. Fail is another loaded term, so I thought about that too, and I didn't. It was so many things like that in a text like this. I thought, is this whole thing going to be like turn people off? Because it sounds a little, especially this kind of Indian treatise way of writing is a little bit like, here's a little bit like the Vinaya texts, and I think he's maybe in that spirit of like, here's these types of trainings. And but I think the meaning is, and Asanga later will compare bodhisattva precepts as like, you can't ultimately fail. He'll say things like this. And you can always keep restoring it, as opposed to some of these earlier precepts that where you there's certain precepts, monastic precepts, that if a monk breaks, they're called defeats, and they're excommunicated, and they can never receive them again in this lifetime. So it gets really strict, and he's saying, the Mahayana is not like this. So we maybe also hear it in the context of this tradition that has some really like serious stuff about failing and breaking, and he's saying it's actually much more giving and compassionate than that. But I agree, fail. I think we fall short, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Or fall or go off track.
Off track, yeah, go off track. Mm-hmm. I think is the meaning.
I think I like the fear thing, actually, whether it's fear of shame, mm-hmm. failure, or embarrassment. I think we really do require something
yeah.
to keep us
yeah.
on the... To keep us aware,
mm-hmm. yeah,
and mindful and vigorous.
Yep, the guardians of the world.
And fears.
Yep.
Yep.
It
works.
Even if it's unpleasant, because it's not unpleasant when we're actually on track.
Yeah.
So it's kind of nice that there's something unpleasant when we're not on track, right?
Yeah.
And if it's not, you know, unpleasant is one way to look at this. If it wasn't unpleasant, then we'd go off track really easily, and it wouldn't. If it didn't bother us, then it would be a world would start becoming a mess.
Become less aware.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, one thing I think about these dharmas, wholesome and unwholesome dharmas, the Buddha is talking, I think he's talking to people who have a sense of a self. Mm-hmm. I think at some point, because all these things like fear of blame and embarrassment do involve a sense of self. But I think, well, we do have a sense of self. And I would say it's sort of built in here that, like, if you actually practice in this wholesome way and then and including opening to this wisdom eventually that there is no abiding self, then maybe you don't have this kind of fear and embarrassment, but it goes, also, you don't ever go off track.
Mm-hmm.
I think they go together. So if you're at the point where you realize it's kind of like deluded, isn't it, to think of like to be embarrassed about what others think? Well, it is kind of deluded in a way, but in this way that works. And if we really get over that delusion in an authentic way, then we don't harm others. This would be my understanding. You could say we could, if it's not authentic, we could say, well, I don't care what others think because like there's no self here, so I'm gonna just do whatever. I think that's sometimes. People might start thinking that way, and then I would say it's not authentic realization of no self, because the authentic one means there's no reason to harm others. So it all works together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a thought that you know, that it's you know, to act, you know, outside of the precepts is suffering,
mm-hmm.
and we're not necessarily aware of the suffering, but you know, when you hold the precepts in mind, it's like you become aware of the suffering, the suffering that, you know, and that's maybe that shame or that embarrassment or that feeling of failure or something
mm-hmm.
like that. It's kind of like conscious. You
yeah.
know, it's more conscious.
I think there's different, we do suffer, I think, when we go yeah. outside the precepts, and we suffer partly because we see that, like, usually it causes suffering to others,
mm-hmm.
and then that we feel actually connected, and
yeah.
and therefore we suffer there, but and then there's these two other types of suffering that aren't necessarily due to the suffering of others. They're more internal.
Yeah.
They're more self-based.
Yeah.
And that's what he's bringing up here. And then, in this paragraph, I thought this is a really interesting explanation for doing the ceremony of receiving them from a person. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I never had heard this elsewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, instead of just, I'm just going to do all good. This is like saying the essence is to receive it, or them, maybe we'd say. Yeah, that was when he said ethics. To receive Shila, precepts from someone else. So these four things, receiving them from someone else, I think means in a ceremony. To have a purified intention means we actually want to actually practice them ourselves. To make correction after falling short
mm-hmm.
means like to kind of confess and repent and like, oh, but no, I really do want to do that. I'm back on board. And to avoid falling short by generating respect and maintaining, remaining mindful. So because one correctly received from someone else, when the bodhisattva falls short, then dependent on the other, I think he means the teacher, actually, the person you received it from, embarrassment will arise. And I think, yeah, I have that experience. I've had times where, and I've tried, you know, I've done both ways. In my own practice, of course, I've received the precepts several times from my teacher. Even after Jukai and then priest ordination, there were times when I felt like I'm falling really short on these precepts to the point where I have to receive them again. I just felt like. And there are precedents in the Mahayana for doing it again and again, as well as the monthly renewal. But I wanted to actually do the ceremony again. And I would, you know, I had to sort of push him to do about that, but he let me do it. I was really into this precepts thing for a while, really looking at conduct really carefully. Maybe I've become somewhat lazier as time goes on. And I think there were times when I felt like if I would go against certain things, I would think of my teacher, you know, really like, oh, I've got to tell him right away, because I feel, you know, because it's this thing that we did together. We'd made this kind of commitment together. He gave me this. It's also this. I received this gift from him, and I feel like I'm like violating the gift or something. And then there's other times when I've made my own personal vows. I'm like, well, I don't, you know, this is just like my own thing. He already thinks I'm maybe too into too many precepts and stuff. So I wouldn't even tell him. I have my own internal commitment, and then I change my mind. And I'm like, no, let's change it over here. And like, I wouldn't feel, it's like, well, nobody knows about it but me. It was an internal commitment, so I feel a little something there. But like, it's much easier to change my mind compared to when somebody else knew about it. And you could say, and then doing a kind of public ceremony, which is what we usually do too, is more than just the teacher. Then it's like, this whole group, I said this. That really makes it hard. And I thought it's really like a very practical function, kind of psychologically, right, that Asanga notices here. And with these two dharmas of free and apatrapya, the free is more about due to one's own strong intention. I really want to follow this. Then we feel this. We go against our own self-respect that felt that purified intention. And the apatrapya, the fear of embarrassment kind of piece, is because we received it from somebody else. See how those two are connected? So there's these four things. So because one received it from someone else, embarrassment will be born. Because of the purified intention, then dependent on oneself, sense of shame will be born. Correcting the bases of training after falling short and generating respect so that failure will not occur, falling short will not occur in the first place, are both causes for the bodhisattva's freedom from regret. So, I think, you know, our monthly precepts renewal is very much about the getting back on track, remembering to get back on track, and the and, you know, remembering them, try not to fall too far off track. Our causes for bodhisattva is freedom from regret, which I think of. I haven't found this elsewhere, but one place I did find this particular teaching when looking for how do these three trainings, all through Buddhism, of Sila, Samadhi, Prajna, Buddha would again and again talk about these three. This is the entire path, and the Eightfold Path is all, it can be fit into Sila, Samadhi, and Prajna, and it's like, you could say the whole thing, ethical conduct, meditative concentration and presence, and wisdom, that realizing selflessness, and they all kind of work together. It's a nice threefold summary of practice, and it's usually taught in that order. And you can see, oh, meditative concentration, you need this strong foundation for wisdom to arise. You need to be really present in your own experience to have insight. So the connection between those two seems more obvious to me, and Zen talks maybe a lot about that part. But then how is the Shila leads to samadhi, or the ethical conduct is a condition for meditative concentration. How are those so connected? I had this question for a long time. I mean, we can see some things like you need to be kind of like stable. If your life is a total mess because you're like getting it, you have all these confused relationships with everybody because you're causing all this harm, then when you sit down for zazen, it's going to be very hard. Your mind's going to, oh man. But I never found this expressed explicitly until in the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification. Buddhaghosa, the author, says something like, what's the purpose of Shila in this kind of three-part training thing? Instead of saying the purpose is to not harm others, I think that is a purpose. But he's saying, as to develop samadhi, the purpose is freedom from regret or freedom from remorse. I thought, there it is. It's like you practice precepts so your mind isn't like bogged down in regret and remorse. I think is a simple way to put it. And then based on this freedom from remorse and regret, then you can really settle into sitting. So there's maybe this reference here of is these practices are the cause for a bodhisattva's freedom from regret. So dependent upon correctly receiving precepts and the purified intention to wanting to keep them well oneself, we could say self-respect and conscience are produced. With the sense of self-respect and conscience, the correct receiving of precepts will be preserved. Preserving it, one will be free of regret. And then continuing, these two phenomena, the correct receiving and the purified intention, are what induce the other two phenomena, correction after failure or falling short, and respect that avoids falling short. These three phenomena, the correct receiving from someone else, the quite purified intention oneself, and respecting the precepts to avoid falling short, should be understood to effectively prevent the falling short of bodhisattva precepts.
I don't mind failure.
What's that?
I think failure is fine. I mean, if you're thinking like, let's say you're trying to think about being honest, and you recognize that you said something that wasn't quite, well, you failed.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah. But then we feel a little like shame and embarrassment.
Right? Yeah.
And it's okay. But it's a little bit painful, right? I mean, if it's not painful, I think then the Sangha would say, then we don't have enough shame and embarrassment. Like, it's wholesome if it's a little painful when we fall short. So you could say, or, you know, like, it's okay to fail. I mean, ultimately, of course, it's okay. And if we're really, if these dharmas of self-respect and decorum are working well, then it will be painful to fall short. And so it's okay, but it's painfully okay. And so this is the path to the end of suffering. It's kind of like, I think from this perspective, it would be like, we're going in the direction of like falling short less and less. So, you know, in Zen tradition, this whole thing would be a little bit like, from a non-dual perspective, we maybe shouldn't even study something like this, right? Because it's kind of dualistic and like, you're kind of like developing. But I think that's one way to look at precepts. This is a very conventional way to look at precepts. It's like, you're actually like evolving in a more wholesome way. And of course we fall short again and again. We fall short and we get back up. But then we actually have the intention to fall short less and less, wouldn't you say? And then that's why these words shame and embarrassment are kind of loaded, because if we feel if they get too heavy, then we're really suffering too much, right? Oh, I feel short again. I'm worthless. I can't do this practice. I should just forget the whole thing. Like then, I think then they've gone over the top, and I think that's what we've talked about a little bit of. It maybe in our modern culture, especially, or maybe the Western world, we have more of this sense of low self-esteem, maybe, so that these could be like big triggers for like, oh, actually shame and embarrassment could like drag us down. I'm failing again and again, and it's like actually it's horrible. I'm like getting totally depressed about it. Then I think we've gone too far. If it's just like self-respect and decorum, it's like, oh, I fell short, and I'm a little embarrassed and ashamed, but I have enough self-esteem to be like, and like, ooh, ouch, ooh, and let's get back up and keep going. That would be, I think, a kind of healthy way to, wouldn't you say? Like, something like that.
Did you remember that we had a thing happen at Green Gulch where somebody really, really acted against the precepts? Mm-hmm. And Reb had a meeting at which the person faced all of us.
Oh, yeah.
Who cared deeply about him. Loved him. And wanted
to
make it right.
That's right. That was maybe like really getting the others involved. Maybe he felt like we've already done it kind of individually. Maybe he'd been through it with himself, and there's not enough here. Let's have a whole community thing, expressing care and yet kind of firm. I don't know. You know, I don't know what you thought about that. I have some question. So intense for that person, and I think he kind of handled it, but. Wow, in the center of a circle of the whole community. Mm-hmm. Like, we're all going to talk about your conduct now. Mm-hmm. Whoa.
Yeah, I mean, it was heartbreaking
for
me because we were so close.
And,
that he did that, whatever it was, you know, was such a transgression.
Mm-hmm.
It affected everybody who loved him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people got to express that, and I think people were, because they could feel the intensity of the situation, they didn't really get into it, but as I recall, some people were pretty, weren't like, we love you and how can we support you? Some people were really like, I can't believe you, how could you? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It was pretty intense.
It was very intense. But kind of some of this, what
you're
talking about.
Yeah. Sort of yeah. And maybe that was the intention to like, nothing else has been working so far. Let's bring even more, a bigger group will be even more embarrassing. Mm-hmm. Which I think it is. I question, is this too much? Mm-hmm. I think it was, you know, the teacher and the student feeling about his relationship with the student was like, I think this person can handle this and they won't completely crack under this. And he didn't crack. So.
But the goal was,
yeah.
The goal was correct.
To help, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting in thinking about, punishment and prison in our culture is a little bit about this kind of like, that's another step, but it's like we have these, repercussions if people break certain precepts, there's legal repercussions, which in the Buddha's time, it was kind of in the Buddha's order for the monks. He did kind of set things up like that. That they were like, this is very different from our bodhisattva precepts, Japanese style, but there's like these different gradations of precepts, and there's different, it's not just like, try to keep them, and if you don't, well, try again. It's more like, there's very specific things that will happen if you don't, but all within the Sangha. Like the least ones are just like confessing to your teacher or something like this, and the ranging up to the greatest ones are like you're out and there's no way you can ever come back, which is not very like compassionate feeling, right? Well, isn't there room for rehabilitation? That's why, that's a difference with the Mahayana. There is always room. The correction of falling short should be understood to constitute rectification and recovery from falling short. To undertake and proceed to train oneself in the essence of precepts endowed with these four qualities should be understood as wholesome because of benefit for oneself, benefit for others, benefit for many people, happiness for many people, mercy for the world, and a welfare, benefit, and happiness for divine and human beings. So after all this a little bit sort of scary, this sort of admonishing kind of talk, it's like, this is about great happiness and joy. That's what the whole point of this is for everyone. And it takes some, you know, takes some work. Because measureless comprehends the bodhisattva bases of training, they should be understood as immeasurable. Because they are lived for the benefit and happiness of all sentient beings, they should be understood to be favorable to all sentient beings. Because they bestow the result of unsurpassed, complete, perfect awakening, they should be understood to be a great result and advantage. What is complete precepts? Briefly, bodhisattva precepts are comprised of the lay side and the monastic side. This is known as complete precepts. Furthermore, based upon the lay side and monastic side, there are, briefly, three sorts. These three pure precepts. The precept of standards of conduct, the precept of embracing good qualities, and the precept of benefiting sentient beings. Among them, the precept of standards of conduct, the first one, refers to undertaking the pratimoksha vow as one of the seven classes. Monk, nun, nun postulant, male novice, female novice, layman, laywoman. So you maybe heard some of these terms. Bhikshu, bhikshuni, shikshamana, you maybe never heard. Shramanera, shramanerika, upasaka, upasika. Are these words that are still sometimes used. So this is referring to something that we don't have. We have, like, you know, pieces of it in our tradition, but we don't call them these things so much. As you may know, you know, Japanese Zen is a very unusual system in the world of Buddha Dharma, in that we have these, we don't have pratimoksha precepts. We're like the only Buddhist, Japan's the only Buddhist country that doesn't have this. You know about this? So everywhere, both Theravada and Mahayana, you know, and Vajrayana, all these traditions the Mahayana, they all have pratimoksha precepts or vinaya precepts, both for lay people and monastics. And then the Mahayana countries have, in addition to that, they have bodhisattva precepts. So maybe we can't tell this whole story now. I think it's time. Because this is like a...
Remember there's the five sort of simplified precepts. Is that what you're talking about? Are those the pratimoksha for lay people?
Yeah. Maybe we can, next time. I think this is important to know just because it's a really unusual part of our tradition and it has big implications. And I think it made Zen, part of what it made Zen maybe more popular. Is this really we only have bodhisattva precepts. And they're the same for lay people and monastics. That's even more radical. The same precepts. All of the Buddhist countries are like different precepts for these seven different groups. So, yeah.
And like I heard in one tradition, it's like 273 precepts.
Yeah. In fact, all other traditions, except Japan, it's 200 something, that they don't necessarily always follow literally, but every country except Japan has 200 for monks and 300 and something for nuns. Okay. So they have them. So we have a very simplified version. And
some of them, like I heard once, is not to ride on an elephant or something like that.
Things like this, yeah. Some of them, like maybe half of them, you naturally keep without even realizing it. Right? Or you have to live in India to break them, right?
Yeah.
But I'll just, you know, end by saying that we do actually have, you could say, the pratimoksha precepts for lay people are the five basic precepts, and the first five of our 10 bodhisattva precepts are basically the five lay precepts. So in a way we receive that. And in that way, you know, strictly speaking, from the point of view of other Buddhist countries, the priests here are all lay people. Because we don't have the next level up of even the novice monk's precepts, we don't have. So this is, there's more about this story. It could come next week. but here he's saying at first just that that's the only thing he's going to say in this first iteration of the first pure precept is the standards of conduct is just these different classes of pratimoksha or vinaya precepts for these different types of practitioners. And so he's not even going to say anything other than that. I mean, he will later. So this was some background. We maybe have more background, but I think as we get into it, he starts actually talking about this is how a bodhisattva actually like meets people, and they say this and that, and they can get kind of detailed things that you can actually do. But he's setting up the whole structure first. So we offer any merit generated here to all beings everywhere. May they be free and happy. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.